Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the show tonight, that show being Movie Geeks United. I am Jamie.
And I am Jerry. Welcome to probably one of our most fun shows that we've had. We have Chewbacca on tonight, so
I know.
Can't go wrong with that.
That's great. This is in honor of the 30th anniversary of The Empire Strikes Back. It's tied in with that. And we're going to be welcoming more guests from related to the Star Wars series and that film in particular before the year is out. But tonight, we're welcoming, as Jerry said, Peter Mayhew, who plays Chewbacca. Have you ever been, Jerry, to, you know, a Star Wars convention or any type of sci-fi fantasy convention?
No, I haven't, but I know that he is a popular attraction there, and I, and rightfully so. I mean, he's, you know, played. I mean, his story is very interesting.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting story. And I, by the way, that book, but this all really revolves around the big coffee table book that came out last week, The Making of the Empire Strikes Back.
J.W. Rinsler, yeah, he's one of the guys that we're going to talk to soon on the show.
Yeah, I ordered that because I ordered the first, the Star Wars one. I guess in 2013 there'll be a Return of the Jedi, and I won't go any further than that. The first one is as far as coffee table books, is a beautiful book, and I can't wait to get the second one in the mail soon. They're just beautiful books, and even if you're just not interested in Star Wars, if you're interested in how movies are made, they're really worth it. If you don't have any books on Star Wars, this is the one to own, this series.
Yeah, and J.W. Rinsler, he's their go-to guy. He's the guy that produces all the how-tos the making of books. He did a great one for the original Star Wars, and you know there are encyclopedias out there, and it's a whole obviously a universe unto itself.
Yes, it is.
And he's a main contributor to that universe and continuing that legacy.
Mm-hmm.
So let's actually get to our interview with Mr. Mayhew here at the top of the show. It's interesting how he was starting a film career. He was an actor, and he just kind of happens upon this opportunity. This applies to everyone associated with Star Wars that changed their lives forever. I'm sure they were shocked that it became a phenomenon themselves. So they knew that they had a strong movie that had the potential for mass audience appeal, but, you're talking about the globe, dominating the globe.
Yeah.
No one does not know Chewbacca. No one does not know the Star Wars series. It's an amazing phenomenon to live with, too, because he still interacts with the fans all the time. I mean, that's full time. He's going out and meeting with the fans that are still as rabid as ever about this series. So let's begin the conversation that we had with Mr. Mayhew concerning his opportunity to star in Star Wars and the legacy that's continued since. Here he is.
Luke Skywalker and Han Solo rescued the princess, destroyed the Death Star, but their story didn't end there. Creators of the biggest smash hit of all time bring you the next episode in the Star Wars saga, The Empire Strikes Back.
Oh.
continuing story of our band of heroes. Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, Han Solo, C-3PO, R2-D2, and Chewbacca.
It didn't take long, your audition for Star Wars, but how did the opportunity come about to begin with for it?
I had worked on a previous movie, which was Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew people that were in the business. So when they were looking for someone big for a movie, my name was put forward, and consequently we went up for the interview, and, you know, the rest is history.
So you only had one audition in front of Mr. Lucas for the first Star Wars?
That's right.
Wow.
About 20 minutes.
So when you kind of developed the character of Chewbacca,
mm-hmm.
From the script, from your conversations with George Lucas, and from your own imagination, how did that characterization develop? What were your thoughts on who Chewbacca was?
I think it was a challenge. When you mm-hmm. think about it, you look at a drawing, which is one-dimensional, and how do you change that into a three-dimensional character?
Right.
Knowing, sort of looking at the composition of the character, it was a bear, it was intelligent, and the only thing it couldn't do was humanly talk, communicate with everybody else. But once the character was formed, everybody seemed to know what Chewie was talking about.
Yeah.
So he communicated in various grunts and growls and body language.
Right. And very loyal to Han Solo.
Yeah, well, think about it. He owes his life to, according to certain people, he owes his life to Han. Naturally, you're not gonna screw that relationship up.
Right. How did you get along with Harrison Ford? Was there a good camaraderie?
Yes, there always was, and there still is today.
Obviously, your life changed after Star Wars,
mm-hmm.
but at what point did you realize that it had changed?
I think when, all right, you get all the publicity and stuff, and with Star Wars, all the concentration was on the main characters, not the background characters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 3PO, R2, those were the kind of, with the three, with Harrison, Mark, and Carrie, their characters were all the publicity stuff. Chewie, R2, and 3PO were background characters, basically. They were the storytellers. And it wasn't until Empire came out that the actual characters became part of that major grouping rather than just background characters.
Yeah. Empire, I'm curious to know, because those first three films, obviously George Lucas directed the first one, and he he's the master of all of them. He oversees
yeah.
all of them. He's the creator.
Mm-hmm.
But you have different directors in Empire and Jedi.
Yep.
Did that make each project kind of a distinct experience unto itself?
Well, I think you've only got to look at the movies. They are totally, totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Empire was directed by Harry Kirshner.
Mm-hmm.
Who did a very, very good job on it. He and George worked together on it. And Irvin, take the three directors. George was a man of very little conversation. He knew what he wanted, and he could explain to you how he wanted it to do it.
Yeah.
Kirsch, on the other hand, was a show director. He'd show you what he wanted, and then he'd give you maybe 20% as an actor to use to get the best out of that particular character. Mm. Richard Marquand was an actor. He was an actor before he became a director. Therefore, he knew what it was like to wear costumes. So he wanted to get them in, done, and out as quickly as possible. So, you know.
And for you as an actor, which one do you feel more appreciative of? Which style were you more receptive?
Learning from experience, I enjoyed Empire because of what Kirsch was able to impart to us.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like he knew what the character was as much as we did, as much as I did.
Yeah. Between the three movies, I'd like your take on it and the role of Chewbacca. Is there an arc that you can see? Is there a development that you can see that you can articulate to our audience?
Well, there was a definite arc. There was a definite improvement. As I just said, he became a major character rather than a minor character as he was in Star Wars.
Right.
You know, it's like the first chapters of a book. All your characters are there, and after the during the first chapter, and during the second and consequently other chapters, all those characters come out. Come out if the author's, you know, if he knows what he's doing.
Between movie geeks, I mean, all the movie geeks that speak among each other, and I'm sure it's the same with all the fans you meet all around the world. They probably all have their own opinion on their favorite of the series, but Empire is held in really high regard. Yeah.
Yes.
And when you saw the actual film for the first time, I'm wondering what your impressions were of it.
I thought it was good, and, you know, it was up to the Star Wars standard or higher. Therefore, all that was ever promised that it would be of the same standard as Star Wars at that particular time. Obviously, over the years, where they've made improvements, and especially in Empire, opening up Cloud City as against the ball in the sky. If you take those, you know, in the main console, you take those windows out and you put outside it, and it makes it a whole different world.
Yeah.
So it was improving all the time.
Was there a sense of nervousness about the second one because it being the middle chapter, it was bound, there was not any kind of resolution, and it was darker. It was a much darker.
Oh, yeah, it had to become darker. Because of the threat from the dark side of the Force,
mm-hmm.
So, you know, and with the Emperor, it's a battle against sort of the good guys against the bad guys.
Well, I want to ask you about the fans real quick because you've had interactions with countless fans. You're very loyal to them, and you attend all the conventions and the events and. Tell me about that family of fans and your experiences with them.
Well, when you think about it, now, for some time, you've had three generations of fans.
Yeah.
It's become a family, true family sci-fi film. Oh, the whole saga. Because the kids that went and saw the original have now become parents, so they are bringing their kids up in the same vein as they went through, and it's interesting to watch the youngsters share the love of Star Wars. So it's something that the kids or the youngsters can share with their dads.
Yeah.
That is family. That to me is family. We see it weekend after weekend after weekend at every convention. The kids come up, they're 2, 3, 4 years old, they're dressed in either Jedi clothes or any of the characters. And they're loving it. They have a ball because they can play, they can be who they want to be, and they can do no wrong as far as their parents are concerned.
Yeah. Do you think it's the mythology aspect of it, the timeless characters, or what do you think people
well,
have?
It's a fairy story. It's a fairy story brought up to modern day, and it's got everything that a fairy story needs. There's no blood. There's no gore, or very little gore. You don't see, apart from, all right, Luke losing his hands, but that was shot extremely well, you know, and as I say, it's a fairy story that you can take your grandmother to, and you can take your baby sibling to.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. All of them are great movies.
Very much so. What were your, because I know you're involved in the newer Star Wars,
yes.
too, in the Sith, Revenge of the Sith.
Yep. Yep.
And obviously George Lucas, you know, in the 2005, he's working in a completely different toy box than existed in 77.
Oh, yeah, of course he is. Of course he is.
Have been a real different experience for you.
It was great. It really was. You know, I got the phone call that they were going to do 3 and that they needed, you know, they needed the character.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the story, because Chewie and Yoda, which brings in another character from Empire, Chewie and Yoda have been associating a long time, but it's never come to light that they are part of the same band.
Right.
So Chewie has to be there to get Yoda to escape so that it can join up with Episode 4. You know, it was great to be able to go back and learn stuff that, remember, the first 3 were the ones that were completely digital.
Right.
And most of them were shot with CGI on them. So that's 2 things that it was remarkable to watch how things were done. And also to go back as, I like to think, the older professor at a university.
Right.
Someone that's been there, done that, got the T-shirt, got the degree, now comes back and is enamored by his students. And that's what it was. You know, we walked into the studios. Everybody came up, had a bit of nice to work with you, blah, 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 and stuff like this. And it was just amazing to be able to do something like that. But I also have a little story. They're out there, and I'm waiting on something, and suddenly there's a knock on the door, and a door opens, and there is Count Dooku. It was Christopher Lee. He'd come back to the studios in Australia, and he came over in his famous voice and said, "Hello, my name is Christopher Lee. How are you?" And that absolutely made that movie for me.
Oh, I bet.
He was one of my heroes. Right?
Oh, he's a legend. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, he's a legend. And he's a fabulous guy, really. And going back a little bit, having met and worked with Alec Guinness, who was another one of my heroes.
Yeah.
Having met 2 heroes in a lifetime, that to me was just, yes.
Yeah, so I can imagine.
It was just a fabulous thing to come back and be involved in Episode 3. It was unexpected, But it was there, you know. It was great.
Did you find that a different George Lucas?
Nope.
Had he changed at all?
Nah, he's just got older.
Yeah.
Everybody, because we're around about the same age, you've all grown up and you've all got older. So it's like meeting an old college friend after 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're the same person, otherwise you wouldn't still be friends with them. So, you know, George hasn't changed. He's still got the philosophy. He's still a wonderful, wonderful person. And he's just indescribable, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he hasn't changed not that much. Obviously, everybody changes, but George doesn't change that much.
Well, when you watch these films, can you ever, because I know you're always bombarded with questions and fans want to hear from you, and so your Star Wars is a constant part of your life and your conversation. But when you watch the films now, after, mm-hmm. 30 years, can you watch it as a viewer? Can you separate yourself from the experience?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you have
yeah.
to. It was a job. It was a job that was extremely, how can I put it? It was a job that was extremely intricate at the time. But now you come back and you watch it and you go, yes, I'm glad I did it that way rather than doing it any other way.
Yeah.
You just go and you watch it. And sometimes I'll watch, if we have time from being on the road, I'll sit down and watch them, purely just to remember, just to refresh your memory, because it's part of your life.
What's going on, buddy? You're being put into carbon freeze.
What if he doesn't survive? He's worth a lot to me.
The Empire will compensate you if he dies. Put him in.
Hey! Listen to me! Chewie! Chewie, this won't help me! Hey!
Save your strength. There'll be another time. The princess. You have to take care of her.
You hear me? Huh?
Okay, that was Peter Mayhew, who immortalized Chewbacca in the Star Wars franchise, talking about that legacy and how it is ongoing. It will never end.
It won't ever end. I mean, it's just, and that's good. I mean, I think that was part of the intention early on, that it would go on forever. I didn't think it would go on this long. I really did think that after Return of the Jedi and a couple of years afterwards, that interest had finally gone away completely, but it had burned out for a while.
Yeah.
And
well,
then
I guess
came back
just
in '91 with a vengeance.
I guess it's just the generations, the older generations introducing the younger ones to what they loved as kids, and I'm sure those movies will be around forever. I mean that evolution will continue to evolve.
Oh yeah, I think it's a given now. I think it's going to be around as long as there are movies, as long as the fans are around. I mean, the original trilogy will always have a special place, I think, in everyone's heart. And I actually think the prequel trilogy for the younger fans will have a special place in their heart, because that's what they grew up with.
Yeah.
So it sort of balanced out.
Did you notice the cell phone, his cell phone that rang in the middle of the interview? And
yes. Yes, I did. I caught that.
Yeah, it was the Star Wars, like laser guns.
That's cool. Good for him.
That was funny. So thank you, Mr. Mayhew, for giving us your time. And we're going to cover more Empire Strikes Back throughout the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So will you be buying the Star Wars Blu-rays?
I'm not. I got to be honest. It's in the chat room. I have so many different versions of this. I'm not eager to buy the Blu-ray because I don't know how long Blu-ray is going to be around for. I have this horrible feeling Blu-ray is this transitionary stage.
Between DVD and what, hologram?
Hologram or 3D Blu-ray, as you brought out.
Yeah. Well, you know, you know 3D is going to be coming.
Yeah, it's coming. That's Sony, in all seriousness, has their new CEO over the, I think the last year, has said that they're putting all their money, all their research into 3D technology.
Right.
So I don't know. We'll see. I hope Blu-ray does last a little bit longer. It's bad enough that in the last couple of weeks we've been reading articles about DVD is pretty much on the way out.
Right.
Which I find, like, frightening in one level because it's not really that. It's still relatively new, when at 97, but I guess that's really archaic by today's standards. So,
yeah, I mean, you recall the whole because it was right. It was between HD, DVD,
mm-hmm.
and Blu-ray, and I remember we did a 10th anniversary of DVD show,
mm-hmm.
the DVD
that's
format
right.
show, and that's when those two formats were competing. And, you know, which one would win out, and people have their own opinions of it, but obviously Blu-ray ended up winning out. But you don't want – I know it's discouraging because it was discouraging for me when I invested so much money and I had this huge library of Laserdiscs.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was something exciting about collecting Laserdiscs because they were large, they were bulky, they looked great on your shelf. You know,
mm-hmm.
it felt like a thing you collect. And the idea was so new of commentaries and scene-by-scene stuff. And then DVDs came out, and I was really resentful of the DVD
right.
format.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that's not going anywhere. Until, you know, I finally had to give up my Laserdiscs and start purchasing DVDs. And now we're going through the Blu-ray and whatever comes out after that. So I know it's discouraging to feel like you're shelling out all this dough for a new format when the other one gets outdated so quickly. But what else do you want from technology? I mean, that's
yeah.
technology for you.
Yeah, that is. It just
and you don't want to stop the progress, you know?
No, you don't want that. You definitely don't want that.
So I can't imagine what will be next. I mean, I think 3D is a way of making films more interactive and immersive in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, are we going to – I hope we don't go to fully kind of interactive movies. I hope movies aren't going to be relegated to being just like video games in the future. I mean, we've already had some of that kind of stuff. But
mm-hmm.
they should be separate experiences, you know. The video game – the interactive video games and the 3D technology and that realm is one thing, but you can never – you can never lose the storytelling aspect of motion pictures.
Oh, yeah, so. Once you lose the storytelling aspect, then it's like you say, it becomes a video game. Once the viewer, it's like becomes like a choose-your-own-adventure novel from the 80s or whatever. Once it becomes that, and those
yeah.
are fine. Those are great growing
up. You will
up,
notice time
wrong.
To turn the page when you hear
yeah.
R2-D2 beep like this.
Yeah.
I have that. I still have that story record.
Yeah.
Star Wars. yeah, but you can imagine that happening, like
oh, yeah.
Them trying to make films more interactive in that respect.
And I wouldn't put it past some of the studios to think, oh, my God, this is the greatest idea ever. The greatest
yeah.
idea is down.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Okay, we're about to get into film editing, the art of film editing. So, Jerry, I'll open this up to you first. What if you had to choose, like, the three prime examples of great editing? Just three movies that come to mind. They don't have to be the definitive for you, but
The Godfather, JFK, and Pulp Fiction.
Oh, very good. Wow, okay. Could you have answered any quicker? That was
Well, you gave me time a couple of seconds there. I just said because hey, let's be very honest. The reason I picked The Godfather, and I think everyone should really know this, is because if that was told the way it was originally written in the way Mario Puzo won it, you would not have that editing of the baptism sequence and what would follow.
Yes.
It's so important because if that was told like really just straightforward, it wouldn't have the excitement. It wouldn't have the tension. But
it wouldn't be nearly as operatic. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. With JFK, I mean, that is a movie where the editor, I have to say, is the star of the movie. That is all about editing. And in Pulp Fiction, the way that's, you know, in all Tarantino films, but especially Pulp Fiction, and I'd even go to say the both Kill Bills, Sally Menke is a real star there.
Yeah. There is interesting editing going on now that, and I think Tarantino started this ball rolling with Pulp Fiction,
mm-hmm.
with the multiple storylines, the kind of deception of time that takes place in more and more movies. So there's interesting things going on with editing in that respect. And people refer to editing as the invisible art.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true.
Most of the time
you should not mention it. But we've mentioned a couple, JFK being my prime example, too, and of course Bonnie and Clyde, which is renowned for its editing, that do draw attention to the editing, but in a way that completely serves the story. It doesn't draw attention to itself that it takes you out of the movie. It immerses you farther into it.
Right.
Yeah, which I think is an important distinction to make. So we're going to be delving into editing right now for a few minutes and an exciting new website that is filled with resources and ideas and interviews and enlightening instruction for all lovers and practitioners of the art of film editing. The site can be found at I don't think I have to say that anymore. I think people realize it. artoftheguillotine.com. And we are pleased to welcome the site's founder, Mr. Gordon Burkell, to our show. I'm going to bring him up here. Gordon, are you with us?
I believe so. How are you?
Hi, hey, Gordon. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
No, thank you. This is a great podcast today. It's following Chewbacca. I don't know if I can do that.
Well, we're pleased to have you on. I love this website. So we're definitely going to discuss the contents of this website. But tell me about yourself, because you've been a film editor for, you know, more than a decade. What drew your interest in the field, and how did you go about getting into it?
Well, I actually started in sound as a boom operator, and I found out really quickly that I don't like working on set. The hours are crazy, if you've ever
been. True.
And so I slowly made my way into post sound, and then one day I got asked by a guy named Alan Collins to come assist him, and Alan Collins originally cut for David Cronenberg here in Canada.
Mm.
So I started assisting him on documentaries here in Canada and just fell in love with it.
Yeah.
Started moving from there.
What was it about editing that made it a perfect fit for you? What is it in your personality that makes editing a no-brainer for you?
I think it's definitely when you're on set, you're constantly rushing, trying to meet your deadlines, and you're trying to get the last shot before the end of the lights sets down. But with editing, you can sit back for a second and really think things through and examine situations and solve problems, which is a lot of fun. It's like building a huge puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And then rebuilding it backwards. So
did you start the website, the motivation for beginning the website, did you find that there were a lot of misconceptions about editing and its place in filmmaking?
I think the new digital realm, we're sort of losing touch with the technique. A lot of students can easily figure out Final Cut Pro or Avid.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know how to tell the story. And what happened was I got asked by the local university to come give a talk about editing. And I gave the talk, and I would constantly reference editors and well-known editors or well-known films and the techniques and the ideas behind them. And afterwards, the students started asking, where can I learn more about this stuff? And I couldn't find any web pages for them. I couldn't find any articles or anything online. So I started, anything I did find, I started creating a list. And whenever I got asked to the university, I'd give out this list. And a friend just suggested, turn it into a web page. So he's been helping me with that ever since.
Yeah.
That's
and
a great resource. It's an awesome resource because it's so important. And what you said is true. I mean, anyone can, any anybody can master Final Cut Pro or Sony Vegas or whatever, but it is an art form, and it's the difference between a bad movie and a magnificent movie.
And we see that with – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I was going to say, one of the things I tell the students is anyone can push the button, but knowing why you're going to make that cut or why you're going to push the button makes you the editor.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the resources that you provide at the website, artoftheguillotine.com, and by the way, everyone out there, guillotine, G-U-I-L-L-O-T-I-N-E. So tell me how that assists novice editors and you know, professional editors in their craft.
Well, we have several things that we do ourselves. I guess first what we do is we aggregate information from around the world. So any news articles, any videos, anything we can find gets loaded up into the site's archive. So you can actually search it out. But what we found, like I said earlier, is we couldn't find stuff that focused mainly on technique. So we started creating our own. We started with The Cutting Room, which is a podcast we do.
Mm-hmm.
And we go around the world, or right now it's been Canada, the U.S., and we interview the top editors we can find. Right now, I just put up one with Andrew Weissman, the fantastic Mr. Fox, and we examine his work on animation. But we're going to be getting some Australian editors in the next couple weeks coming on for the first time. But then we also have what we're really excited about, which is we teamed up with the American cinema editors, the Canadian cinema editors, and the Australian screen editors to put together a video series where any of their lectures, their talks, panel discussions can get uploaded for anyone to see in the world.
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah, so anyone can actually watch a couple of the EditFest panels from this last summer, including we just put up Thelma Schumacher's talk.
I saw that. Thursday. Yeah.
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 So
That's amazing. And you mentioned your podcast, and I just want to say your podcast is fantastic. I've heard it many times, and I started listening when you spoke to Bobbi Yostein, who's been on our program several times. We love her, and you put on a fantastic podcast. Your podcast is monthly, correct?
I try to, because I still edit, so
right.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's monthly, sometimes I usually try to get one interview out a month at the moment, but sometimes it might stretch a bit.
Right.
So usually it's monthly.
So the podcast is there at artoftheguillotine.com as is a library of exceptional video clips that I've looked through many times as well. Just great teachers, great editors, great teachers that you have featured on the site. What are the most important lessons? As a film editor yourself, what are the most important lessons that you yourself have learned from this series of videos and podcasts that you've done?
There's so much, so much. I'd have to say one of the first interviews I did was with Michael Tronick, who cut Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Hairspray. And he was really nice, and, afterwards he sat me down, and he's like, the day I learned... or the day I became an editor was the day I learned when not to make the cut. And that sort of stuck with me, and that's something that I've been telling other people now. When you know not to make the cut, when you let the actor's delivery speak for itself.
You're right. And we discuss that a lot when we talk editing with various guests, that it is just as important to know when not to cut and to let the actors kind of breathe in a way. That being said, Jerry and I just discussed some of our favorite examples of great film editing. What are yours? What titles come to mind for you?
It's tough because it's like asking someone to choose their favorite film. They're going to have a list of a bunch.
Yeah, that's true. it's a hard thing to choose. It's really hard.
Yeah, I would have to say... I am a big fan of, like I said, Michael Tronick's stuff, and particularly Hairspray. I like musicals. I tend to like musicals.
Mm-hmm.
So I love, one of my favorite films is Singing in the Rain.
And yeah.
the editing in that is more, much more traditional. So I have to say that's more for just a fun film to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. It changes so frequently. Over the weekend, I watched Apocalypse Now.
Mm-hmm.
There was this, Walter Murch was in town giving a special lecture, and so we went and watched that, and it's phenomenally edited. It just,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, which version? Which, the original or the Redux?
We watched the Redux.
Okay.
But what was interesting was to hear him discuss how it was cut or how it was set up for the cut. Because they had more than one editor, and apparently the way they set it up was the more crazy the editor or outgoing the editor, the further along in the story they had them edit.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that you're supposed to slowly lose your mind as you go through it.
Mm-hmm.
So Walter Murch, who's really, you know, together, ended up cutting the first half of the film, and as it got crazier, they went with the other editors.
Right. Do you recommend to the people on your website, do you recommend the book, The Conversations, Walter Murch and the Art of Editing Film by Michael Ondaatje?
I would definitely recommend that. I would also recommend Bobbi Oostein's books.
Oh, yeah. We love her, as Jamie said.
Yeah.
We worship her.
And the book where she interviews her husband, Sam Oostein, I've given that to people as gifts because
mm-hmm.
it sort of gives you a sense of where everything's come from, but also his personality
mm-hmm.
just comes through in those pages, and it's great.
Yeah.
So.
Tell me, because we were discussing the invisible art aspect of editing, as opposed to the films where you really notice it, but it doesn't necessarily take you out of the film. What do you think film editing should be? How would you define how it should work for the movie? Is it possible to articulate that?
It's definitely a hard thing to articulate. I'd have to say that every film is going to be different, so you can't say, okay, this is how we're going to cut it. And you almost have to allow the story to become a life of its own and the edits sort of breathe and find themselves in a sense. Because you're constantly recutting scenes until it works.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times your first initial idea of how the scenes should go together is probably not going to work. And so you're constantly molding this film until it works. The best way of summarizing it is someone once said, you start with a block of marble and you slowly chip away until you have a sculpture. So,
yeah.
I guess
And when you edit, and you hear others discuss this, and we've asked this before of editors, is one of the most difficult parts of it is keeping perspective. I mean, when you're living with every frame of it, and you're reviewing and rewatching, and do you kind of get blurry eyed? Is that the hardest part?
You definitely get blurry eyed. there's an editor here in Toronto named Steve Westlack, who cuts a lot of docs, and he constantly encourages people, and even his directors, to take a week off or take 3 days off and literally just do nothing that has anything to do with the film, and that usually helps you sort of recalibrate and come back in and rewatch the film.
Yeah.
Especially with the tighter deadlines, we're working weekends more and more.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, the website is phenomenal. Lots of valuable video clips, a great podcast. You're a great host on that podcast. I'm envious.
yeah.
But it's a wonderful site, artoftheguillotine.com, and we'll put it up in our chat room too. And Gordon, thank you, my friend. Come
thank
on anytime. Let's
yeah.
talk film editing anytime with you.
Oh, I'd love to.
Yeah, please come back.
Oh, definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you
my friend. All right. Bye-bye, Gordon.
Take care. Have a good one.
Okay, that's Gordon Burkell, artoftheguillotine.com. Check it out. It's a great resource for film editing.
Another
great
film, is Memento.
Yes.
Memento
Another
really
film that
is
plays
one
with
of the
time
great.
And, yeah.
Yeah, you got to bring that up. I mean, of recent films, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, a film that's obviously, I mean, it's made for the editing room. It's it's one of those that are made to come alive. It rises or falls based on its editing.
Mm-hmm.
And The Hurt Locker, we were talking, I remember when we were going over the nominees with Bobby last year, or earlier in the year, rather, and The Hurt Locker was a big favorite in terms of editing.
Yeah.
Because of those very meaningful cuts between the, when he goes from combat and all of a sudden he's in civilian territory.
Yeah,
and,
that's true. Mm-hmm.
He's not acclimated to that environment, and you feel it because it's such a sudden cut. You know, so the editor has just a crucial part to play in the process. Okay, so what's going on movie news-wise? New movies. Did you see enough intelligent talk? You saw Jackass 3?
Yeah, I saw Jackass, and it is something that everyone should go out and see. No, I don't think it needed to be in 3D.
How's the editing in that one?
The editing's great. the editing is just great. Jackass is one of those things. It's like a I don't like to use the word guilty pleasure, but it might apply here for this one. But there's something. There is a. But I have to say that I think the first film is genius. The second one it has its moments. This one, I think we can definitely see the. It's getting tired. I definitely
right.
have to say you do yawn at times. You're like, okay, I think I've seen this before. I don't know if you need the 3D aspect. And I have to say that really a lot of the things I've seen in 3D recently, it's just really to make as much money as you can, it seems like. It is really not much more than that. I don't know if you really needed this in 3D. But there are fun moments, and your heart goes out to these guys because they're just hurting themselves so much. I mean, you feel for them. If you've been, like, since the second one, I've had major surgery on the knee. So my heart goes out to these guys because they're just killing themselves.
Right? Yeah, they're destroying themselves.
Oh, I mean, it's just, they show an X-ray of one of them, and it's just like, oh, my God. Dude, just take it easy. Take some painkillers. Get off the set.
Yeah.
I don't know after a while, you know, after you, I think you said it best before we went on the air, what works in a half-hour environment doesn't necessarily need to be stretched out to 90 minutes. And you are, by the time you get to the end, you're like, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, how much more can you drag this out? But I will say this, it is a fun film. It's an enjoyable experience to an extent. I like what they've done. I don't see what else they can do.
Well, they'll figure it out after a $50 million weekend.
Yeah, I don't see. No, it's a great way to go. I don't see what else you can do. It seems like these guys, through the series and the movies, have really just put themselves to the limits. As we get older, our bones and our bodies are not as elastic as they once were.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking about that, especially watching Knoxville. I was
right.
like, dude, just you
Knoxville,
know that there's
got to
be tons of Vicodin on the set.
Who has to use a catheter every day, Knoxville, because of damage that's been done to him.
That's the thing that I was like, guys, this is the third film, and what you're doing with your members, are you serious? Do you really, you guys must be rich. You must have money set away. I know that the financial crisis did not hurt you that much. But
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I should join the team because I the Jackass team, because, you know, I'd be happy if anything's going on with my member whatsoever. So
stop that. I knew you were gonna, as soon as I brought that up, I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. Anyway, so I've seen the other Jackass films. I've seen the TV series. You know, my personal tolerance. I laughed my butt off at the trailer to Jackass 3D, but I do not like the gross stuff. I do not find the gross stuff funny, and I can't look at it.
No, okay.
The Daredevil stuff is hysterical to me.
Yeah,
it's Three Stooges time, you know?
Yeah, oh, it is. It's great. But let me put it, if you thought the scene in Slumdog Millionaire where the kid falls through and into the that whole thing of shit, if you thought that was bad, don't bother paying to go see this.
Yeah, the Steve-O
outhouse
thing.
Don't bother going to see this then. if you were offended by that or that grossed you out, just stay home.
Yeah, well, I saw Steve-O on Howard Stern because they've been plugging it big time in Howard Stern. And when you're dealing with the Jackass people, you got to be careful what you mean by plugging it. They've been plugging the film on Howard Stern, and Steve-O wanted to have a stunt in the studio where he just covered his hair in hairspray and set it on fire. So, and there was
the smell of
burnt flesh in the studio, and
everyone
was freaking out. But it's funny. I mean, and I can't explain it. And you know, everyone finds it funny. But you know, you and I, we have a heart, so we feel kind of awful. We're biting our nails leading up to it, and then we feel really bad afterwards. But it's like seeing somebody slip and fall.
Yeah.
You know,
the
first reaction is to kind of laugh.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times.
That's why they're doing it. And I've always said, I'll say this, I've always liked Jackass because they obviously enjoy doing it. I hope they enjoy doing it. If they don't, then they really need psychiatric
their
help.
Their heart's in it. Their heart is in it, and you can tell.
And you can tell. You can tell that throughout the film, and I think that's why the films in the series work so well. I'm not a big fan of what has become of MTV in the last 10, 15 years, but this is one of those things that stands out on, like, the Jersey Shore or whatever else.
We won't see that movie.
Oh, my God, I hope. Oh, please. Oh, God.
Jersey Shore. Shore theory.
You had to bring... Okay, I'm sorry I brought up the Jersey Shore. Can we edit that out for future or the replay?
What else has come out? What else came out this weekend?
Red.
Red
is
yes.
good. Red you should see.
What every member of Jackass was left with at the end of their journey. They're left red.
Yeah, that's true. I hear
it's surprisingly subdued, Red.
I will say this. I like it. I actually think it's one of Bruce Willis's best parts in a long time, in quite a long time. But the movie really comes to life when Malkovich enters. Malkovich needs to be given a, with the exception of Jonah Hex, but he has to be given a Most Valuable Player award this year. For this and Secretariat. I mean, I like Secretariat. I thought that was a good movie. But he needs, for this, and I also watched Disgrace finally last night.
Yeah.
Which is superb.
Interesting movie. I mean, that's that part. Tailor-made for Malkovich.
Mm-hmm.
It's ambiguous and just very odd. You know, it's only an actor like Malkovich could pull that off.
Right, but when he comes in, especially Hal Amir, and I think the film really picks up. But it's good. I think it's definitely worthwhile, and it's a good film. And obviously, people responded to it. And looking at the numbers this weekend, but nothing could be Jackass. Really do that this weekend. But it's just a fun film. I think it is subdued, though. It's not whoever cut the trailer. Speaking of editing, should get an Academy Award because the trailer for Red is a phenomenal trailer.
I wonder if that's – I never asked that question. I wonder if that's how some editors start or if that's a rung – if that's like a rung down from editing your own feature, being a trailer editor.
From what I know, as far back as the 80s at least, that was a cottage industry. That was a select group of people. Now I think these days more – I think – the studios and everything have more control over that, but I remember it was a hard thing just to edit trailers, to make the trailer. That was a specialized field that only a select few were in. I don't know how true that is anymore, but whoever edited this trailer, it's a magnificent trailer. I mean, it definitely sells the movie.
Okay, Dean, I have you on the line. We're going to bring you on in just a second. I just wanted to discuss a couple more things real quick. Speaking of editing and doing like lots of research and stuff for this upcoming Kubrick series,
mm-hmm.
So you know that there is a scene at the end of The Shining that they cut out.
Yeah, you were telling me about this.
Yeah, it was a scene. Jack's frozen in the snow. Then you see like the legs walking in front of his body of state troopers and things, and then it kind of fades into the hospital scene where Wendy's in bed in the hospital. The owner of the Overlook, Barry Nelson, I think mm-hmm. was the actor's name. He walks up into Wendy's room and chats with her, and, you know, idle chit-chat, and then walks out, and Danny's in the hallway playing with bucks or something on the floor. Then he turns around and says, "Danny, I forgot to give you this," and tosses him the tennis ball. And then the movie ends. And then it cuts to the photo of the Overlook and Jack in the photo. So Kubrick actually last minute decided to cut that scene out. So as a result, he had it removed before it opened. But as a result, in some theaters, it played for that first weekend.
Oh, wow.
They hadn't cut it out yet. I managed to find some stills from it last night, from that last scene. It's interesting. And then I'm questioning Eyes Wide Shut, like how much that was cut to.
You
and
really,
not,
Matthew Wilder gave it to you today, but
I know.
That's expected. We love Matthew Wilder, and we hope that Inferno does get made, but yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you like him. And I'm not talking about the orgy scene. I mean, I'm talking about other things that.
Right.
That,
I know what you mean. I know why you like it. So, and it is a good film. So.
Yeah, but in terms of what's been compromised in it, I think it's more than the orgy scene. But I'm determined that we get to the bottom of this in this series for whatever good that will do. anyway. Other movies that opened this weekend, Red came in second with $8 million. Social Network holding strong in third place. It's grossed $55 million so far. Life as We Know It, a moderate hit. The Town is doing well. It's going to town, $77 million. Easy A did very well so far in its cumulative take. So there's some sleepers and some hits out there. You
yeah,
know,
there
Carlo,
are. It's definitely
Carlos played on
season. It's
Carlos played on Sundance this weekend.
Yeah, I recorded that. I don't know when I'll get to watch it, but I do want to see it. I definitely want to see it.
Yeah, yeah. And next weekend is Paranormal Activity 2 and Hereafter.
Wow, that's quite a
combo. Yeah, well, it's a supernatural combo. Come on.
Yeah, and then the following weekend, what do we have? Saw 3D. Yeah. Oh, God. Okay.
But Paranormal Activity 2, we've been told by Paramount that they're not doing any publicity on it. They want to keep everything a surprise. So there's even less known about this movie than there was the first one. I don't know what they're doing with the sequel. But it means one of two things. It means either people will be wowed by it, or it means that, you know, I hate to say this, but the movie's bad, so they don't want to promote it in advance. They want to get those curious people that opening weekend because they know that's all they'll have.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I'm trying to think. It's one of two things. Like, it's either they have something that's great, original on their hands, or they have Blair Witch 2.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's essentially what it boils down to.
Yeah. Okay, let's bring on Dean.
All right.
Hey, Dino. Hang on.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, Dean,
up,
how you
Dean?
Doing?
Pretty good. You know,
where are the sirens, man? I can't hear sirens.
It's rather quiet out tonight. A big fan of Paranormal Activity. I just watched it a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, I've been dreading it. And I watched it, and I was like, boy, this isn't so bad after all. I kind of liked it. I liked it too.
Very effective.
I thought it was good. I mean, yeah.
It is. It's got those two elements. I was really glad that it was just as quiet as it is. It's a pretty quiet movie for being a horror film. I think silence is the scariest thing in movies. Silence and darkness. So,
yeah.
Movies like relationships. It's usually the scariest thing.
Yeah, silence and darkness. But I really thought the acting in it was great and everything. I'm not holding any hopes out for the sequel because I'd rather it just stand alone. But they got to do what they got to do.
Yeah.
But I want
that should have been the tagline. Paranormal Activity 2. We had to do what we had to do.
Somebody's got to use that one of these days.
Yeah.
I watched also a couple of other horror movies this week that I was really thrilled with.
House of the Devil.
Yeah, you watched House of
the
Devil, a great film, yeah.
Yeah, The House of the Devil, which I watched mainly because of Greta Gerwig, obviously, because I'm in love with Greta Gerwig, and you know, in case you're listening, she can look me up or whatever. But
But it's not. You brought up a good point today because you were talking about that movie, Greenberg and Please Give, and you on Facebook, that is, and you were upset that those films haven't gotten the recognition you think they deserve.
Yeah, even critically, you know, like it doesn't seem like anybody's like mentioning them as dark horses for anything, like at the Independent Spirit Awards or anything like that.
You never know.
Like everybody's sort of forgotten those two movies. I think Please Give has a little bit more love for it out there than Greenberg does.
People did not like Greenberg. People were just so
they
hated
so
Ben Stiller's character. They hated his character, and the thing was they couldn't relate to his character and things, but I actually think it's probably one of the best things Ben Stiller's ever done, but that's just me.
It's just so funny how people have to – I thought we were past the point of having to – you know, having to love the main character or whatever. Does anybody really love, Henry and Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer?
No, here's the thing, Dean, you must remember, this is what we hear about movies like Greenberg or even less, something like The Informant. The people are not my kind of people. They're not likable. So if they're not likable, if they're not like us, they're not part of our socioeconomic class or whatever, the movie sucks.
That's interesting. I mean, does it mean that it's that we don't like them? We don't want to be that person, or we don't want to hang out with that person, or is that it?
Not only do I want to hang out with that person, I identified with that person very strongly. I identified very strongly with Greenberg and his friends. There was a lot in the movie that was relatable. That's why I liked it so much, and maybe that's a fault of mine, but I really.
I think Greenberg has a lot of anger and humor and hurt inside of him and everything. I didn't hold it against him that he was such an ass most of the time.
But that's, if we're going to the movies to see movies just about people like us, movies would be boring. They would be and we should be taken out and shot. The last thing
people want a character or a lead character in a movie that reflects what they want to be. So, it's not the 70s anti-hero world anymore. I mean, look what movies are popular, Good and Evil, Light and Dark. There's no shades of gray, really, in the most popular movies anymore. So we want to see the same reason why we look at movie stars. We want to be that handsome, and we want to get that beautiful girl. You know, we want to put ourselves in that place. So it's harder as a mass audience to want to be an ass like Greenberg.
Yeah.
But, I mean, no one's out there, crapping on, I mean, everybody still likes to go and watch Taxi Driver. Who wants to be Travis Bickle?
Yeah, but here's the thing. Taxi Driver in his day, though, was not critically well received.
Oh, no. It was. I mean, it had
but there are a lot of people also came out against that film. There are a lot of people repulsed by that film.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, come on,
but,
I mean, you're right.
I mean, that, Taxi Driver was in
history
keeping.
History has been very kind to the film. Taxi Driver
fit in with the anti-hero feeling of the 70s.
Yeah, but
look at Henry. Henry was condemned when it came out. It's only through the years that it's been really, slowly accepted as, a very terrifying, a very good film. But at the time, I remember there was a lot of controversy about Henry and what was it, The Cook, the Thief, the Wife, and His Lover, and Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, were all three of those films were singled out that summer.
Right. Well, Henry is a tough movie to take.
Oh,
the
home invasion sequence still is very scary.
Tony Montana is the interesting specimen because obviously an awful guy. But how many people want to be Tony Montana? I mean, there's a whole culture after that. You know, that's a dichotomy there.
It's a strange dichotomy too, and people are still going back to pay. I mean, people who weren't even near being born yet are still going out and somebody's 16-year-old tonight is watching Taxi Driver somewhere. So,
yeah,
like,
and he will mug
Gordon
you later on the
or Tony Montana still.
What now?
They want to be Gordon Gekko or Tony Montana. That's what they want to be. They always want to be one of those two characters.
I guess it's just because of the money.
It's the money. Yeah,
the
it's all that. I mean,
first you get the money, then you get the power, then you get the woman, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I have zero of those three, so I, you know, obviously
the club. I mean,
the movie appeals to me.
The three of us.
Yeah, no money, no power, no woman either.
Thank God Chris isn't on the show right now. Okay?
Welcome to Movie Losers
playing
United.
Live.
Movie Losers.
Welcome to we're single and you can see why.
Welcome to Movie Losers United.
Chris is just about to have a baby. I mean, not personally, but his wife is.
Yeah, it must be about time, right?
I know, it's getting close, guys. Yeah, I mean, he'll be on the show less. That sucks.
Our first Movie Geeks United birth.
I guess we'll be hearing a lot of crying in the background.
We might. Yeah. Yeah.
That'll be a good podcast. We should air live from the birth room.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah. We should play clips from The Exorcist or something. You know, to
Rosemary's Baby.
Right.
Oh, that's funny.
A little nursery rhyme.
Oh God.
Yeah. That's
anyway.
Great. Let's see. So I watched House of the Devil, which was great. By the way, great 80s period detail in that movie.
Did you see what I wrote on your profile about it, Dean?
I did.
I haven't looked at it yet, but what did you write?
Well, it, because we spoke to Ty West and the lead. Who was the lead in that?
Jocelyn or somebody. I can't remember. But she's in the entire movie. I mean, she's basically in every frame of the movie.
We had them on together, like, when that movie first came out. And it was what struck me about it was that it feels more than a period film. It actually feels like it was made in the 80s. I mean, it transcends.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. It transcends period detail stuff.
It does. It feels like it's been buried in some back room or something, and somebody just unearthed it, you know. And it's because it's got that great. It's got a really good score to it too.
Yeah,
like
it does.
That great 80s sort of music that's playing over the opening credits, and the credits have that sort of weird still. You know, every time a credit comes up, the image stills, and it's just. It's just perfect. Like, everything about it is perfect. I like how it is good detail. It is good 80s detail because it's not overdone. You know, it's done, you know, it's just something about what everybody's wearing is just slightly 80s, you know, and
right.
Greta
it doesn't, Gerwig. It doesn't call attention to itself. You're right.
Biggest thing is Greta Gerwig's haircut, and that's about it.
Right.
You know,
you know, and there's also... It's a special kind of achievement because it has all the cliches in it. I mean,
yeah, it does.
It's got all the horror movie cliches. I mean, the main character is the babysitter, for God's sake, you know. but it works so well. That brings up a good segue because I want to announce this. Next week, leading up to Halloween, we're going to have a special series celebrating some scary movies with new interviews and archived interviews starting – Well, actually, this Wednesday we have Frank Whaley, the actor, Frank Whaley.
Mm-hmm.
Next Sunday we have actor Robert Forster. And then Monday...
Oh, really? Oh, he's great.
Yeah, Jackie Brown, baby, an alligator. Then Monday
alligator,
through Thursday...
Baby, yeah.
Monday through Thursday... I'll just ask him all about Mulholland Drive. I won't even ask him. I'll ask about his one scene in Mulholland Drive. Monday we have John Kenneth Muir returning to analyze the horror genre, and these three titles in particular. Monday night will be Psycho, so we'll have John Kenneth Muir, Tom Holland, who wrote Psycho 2, Stephen Ribello will be playing that interview again too, that wrote Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho, and Robert Galuzzo, who directed The Psycho Legacy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big show that Monday night. Tuesday night will be Texas Chainsaw Massacre with Mr. Muir and cinematographer Daniel Pearl. Wednesday, Blair Witch with the two writers, directors of the film, and star Michael Williams and Mr. Muir returning then. Then Thursday, the series kind of closes with an overall view of the horror genre from Mr. Muir, kind of the state of the genre. You know, you have the State of the Union. We're going to talk about the state of the horror genre. And then Sunday... next Sunday, the actual Halloween night, we'll have producer Gail Ann Hurd on the show talking about The Walking Dead, which is the new AMC TV series directed by Frank Darabont that she's executive producing. And she, of course, did Terminator and Aliens and, you know, a lot of and worked with De Palma. We're going to get a status update on Boston Stranglers, upcoming De Palma film. Yeah. I could tell you what she said now, but I don't want to ruin it.
Don't ruin it for us.
Yeah. So those are upcoming shows. And then we'll announce the winners of the Human Centipede and the Goonies DVDs on are those two polar opposites or what? We'll announce those on that Sunday Halloween night show too. You can win the Goonies and the Human Centipede on DVD. Just don't give it to the same person as a gift.
What the heck kind of questions are you asking for Human Centipede?
Human Centipede is you have to email us, and we've had a lot of entries for this. Email us what movie disturbed you most and why.
Okay.
If that makes sense. I mean, that's not outrageous.
Yeah. No.
No, that's right.
And then the Goonies, we already asked one trivia question. I'll ask it again here, and we've had a lot of responses to it. What future husband of actress Diane Lane co-starred in the Goonies? That's the first question. The second question, your second chance to win, will be this Wednesday night when we'll ask the second question during the show. So go to MovieGeeksUnited.net for full details on how you can win these prizes. We'll try to do this every month. I'd like to give away some stuff. I'd like to be like the miniature movie version of Oprah.
You're kind of like the Monty.
I'd like to win one of these, man. I mean,
you're kind of like the Monty. You're the Monty Hall of the movie podcast.
Yes. Well, behind door number one, you're either going to get the Goonies or the Human Centipede.
I think on one episode of Let's Make a Deal, there was somebody dressed as a human centipede.
Oh, wow.
Oh, God.
That's a deal I would not like to make.
One other horror movie that I watched. I wanted to see if you guys had watched this. This was a couple of weeks ago. Have you guys watched Frozen yet?
Yes.
Very good.
Terrific. What a terrific. It's not quite a horror movie. It's weird. It's kind of weird to call it a horror movie, but it does have elements of one. But it also has sort of elements of a disaster movie in some ways, but but it's so great. I was really kind of blown away by it. One of my favorite movies of the year.
And it's a movie that constantly raises the stakes, which is great. I mean,
very true.
Yeah, which is important in that kind of claustrophobic survival kind of movie, which is what it is. It's like Buried. Adam Green, when we talked to him, he talked about the new movie Buried, and the guy talked to Adam and said, you know, I've got you beat. You got three people on a ski lift. I got one guy in a box.
Yeah. What's next? I mean, what's going to happen next?
Yeah.
Like, how's anybody going to beat that?
Yeah, it'll be some guy with that Chinese finger lock device trying
to
get out of it. That'll be the next 2 hours.
Oh, no.
Waterboarding the movie. Yeah,
hey, I wanted to mention my favorite, like you, when you were asking, like people, you were asking, you know, about favorite examples of editing.
Sure.
I think possibly my favorite example of editing, like the movie that I watched for the editing is really a huge part of it for me. Is Dog Day Afternoon? Strangely enough, D.D. Allen.
That's a great choice.
Yeah, it's just something about the way that movie is put together and the way that it's paced. And you know, when I see something that's really edited really well, I can't put my. It is true that it's an invisible art. I can't put my finger on exactly what it is. But there is something that I like to call crunchy editing, and that means that it just, I'll give you another example. Like, I think that Alan Parker's movies, particularly The Commitments, but also Fame, those two movies in particular have that sort of crunchy editing where it's just like you can't believe how perfectly timed every shot is, and There's just something about it. I don't even know why I call it crunchy, but it just has that sort of visceral thing to it, you know.
Well, if you've ever tried to eat film, it is a little crunchy.
Yeah, it is. You're right. But I've tried to do that.
It's a little, you know, that nitrate aftertaste too, which I get a lot from certain bottled waters as well.
What else was I going to? Oh,
yeah, Dog Day Afternoon is great. Dog Day, and you know the feeling established right away with that great Elton John song at the opening of it, and it's the style of it is, you know, kind of exhaustive when they're in that bank, and also manic. There's you feel the city in that movie in a very special way, and it's interesting because there was a publicist that we worked with for the Sarasota Film Festival, and when I used to attend it, I mean, he got me in all the screenings and everything, and I would attend it, and I shook his hand, and we talked about working together on future guests. His name is Gary Springer.
Oh, yeah.
And he owns his own publicity company. And so I talked to him and corresponded with him forever until I realized he's been in a couple of movies. He was in Dog Day Afternoon. He was the Jerry, he was the third guy that got cold feet at the beginning and said, "Sonny, I can't do this. I got to go." And then he was in Jaws 2. He played role in Jaws 2. Yeah. And so he's played a role in cinema history.
Wow.
I have no idea talking to this guy. It was great.
Yeah, I have a friend that knows Gary, too. So.
Yeah, let me bring up another, you know, I mentioned Memento, but actually a film, let's be honest, one of the films where the editing is key. And if you didn't have the editing, the movie wouldn't work nearly as well, is 500 Days of Summer. Editing is really key there. We fail to bring that up a lot of the time about the film, for those of us that really like it, but that's actually a key success where that film works.
Comedies don't get recognized for their editing all that often, which is a shame because, you know, it's obviously important. I always think of Tootsie as a really well-edited movie.
You're absolutely right.
But no one, you know, it's not like they're well-edited like, you know, Thelma Shoemaker kind of well-edited, but it's just got that, again, that quality, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, I was just watching a movie earlier today, too, called, I was watching it on Hulu, it's called Pretty Ugly People, and it's not a very good movie. And I just wanted to say that. But also, I was watching it, and one of this, I was reminded of my days working doing the film festival down south. And one of the things that I told people to watch, you know, I did the whole program for 2 years, and the second year I did it, I did a pointers thing for filmmakers to read, you know. And I said the two things that have killed your movie faster than anything else is the acting. If you're not paying attention to the acting, if the acting's bad, nothing will save the movie. And if the editing is bad, nothing will save the movie. There's something about, like, paying attention to getting every frame out that you don't, and every single frame out that you do not need, and cutting the shot down to seriously, it's barest essential.
Yeah, you're right.
You know,
brings up The Social Network. We have to bring that up. He's absolutely right. The editing in The Social Network is vital.
It is. It is. And it's another example. See, when I was watching those Pretty Ugly People today, I was looking at it, and I was like, every shot, it looked like they could cut a little bit off of the head. Not every shot, but it looked like you could cut a little bit off of the head and a little bit off of the tail on a lot of shots, and it would that little bit of difference, which seems minuscule and ridiculous to sit here and carp about, but it. Adding it all up, it really feels like it just drags you down, you know. And it makes the shots look kind of phony, too. Like if the shots go on too long, you can kind of sense the phoniness of it and everything. It's something that people have to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
You know, that was the first thought I had. Oddly, the first thought I had when I first walked out of the theater watching Nell, and I haven't watched it since. But there are emotional scenes where they hit the note, And then it kind of lingered on that scene a little too long afterwards. And I thought, man, if they would have spliced that, it would have been much more effective emotionally. You know, we got it. Move on. Kind of thing.
It's true. I mean, like, I used to know when I was looking at new movies coming in, you know, when I was working as a programmer, you know, I would have, you know, tons of movies to watch. You know, like, my whole wall was filled up with movies, and I didn't, you know, it was just, oh, I'm done with that one. Here's another one, you know. Until 1,250 movies were gone, I wasn't done. So I was looking to not like everything, you know. I mean, that way I could get through the piles faster. So I was looking to not like things. So I would put in a movie and know within the first three shots whether the movie was going to be any good or not, because let's say the movie starts up with somebody waking up and there's a shot of the alarm clock going off. If that camera is on that alarm clock too long, I knew immediately that this was going to be trouble. Because, yes, we know it's an alarm clock. It's going off.
Well, speaking of Nell, I just want to say Chickabee Arnate, Tea in the Wind. That's all I want to say. My friend the other night, he watched a movie called Killer Condom.
I've heard of Killer Condom.
I've heard of that.
Have you heard of that? Wow. I can't wait to watch this thing. Did I tell you
watch
the story
it
of him going...
Bill with, watch it on a double bill with teeth, by the way.
Hmm.
Well,
I'm
just curious if we ever played, because when I worked at the theater, when I managed movie theaters, we had a possessed projection booth where every film that we had would break. So I would just look so forward to playing Killer Condom and telling everyone it broke. did I tell you guys about the Scream Fest, the Scream Fest event that my friend went to last weekend?
No, you didn't.
All right. Well, my friend Rick, he who's been on the show before, he went with his brother to the Scream Fest event. The big major attraction there was John Carpenter. So Rick is there. He sees Carpenter on Friday, and then he meets him and has him sign stuff on Sunday. He has no idea that Carpenter suffered a seizure on Saturday and was rushed to the hospital, and then he came back the next day. So I guess he's all right. It was a minor seizure, but so. He's meeting with Carpenter, and he shakes his hand. Carpenter's very nice, and Rick and his brother were there, and he's like, which one of you guys is older? And Rick's brother's like, well, why don't you tell me? And Carpenter's like, I honestly don't know. I don't feel comfortable doing that. So, but the juiciest thing there was Gary Busey was there. This is such a movie star line. So Rick's brother walks up to Gary Busey and says, Busey, you're amazing, man. And Busey looks up at it and says, I'm close enough.
That's the Texas boy in him. He's hilarious, you know.
Oh, what I wouldn't give to see Busey and Nick Nolte having a conversation together. That would be
that would be great. You know, there'd be some hard drinking going on there. I saw once a long time ago, I saw something that I think was done for public access in Texas in like 1976 or something like that, and it had Busey on there, and he was hilarious. It was this, it was this comedy thing, you know, and the young Gary Busey on there with another actor you might know named Gaylord Chartain, who's been in a lot of movies. He played Kathy Bates' husband in Fried Green Tomatoes, and he's been in a lot of other movies. But anyway, they were on there together, and it was just great Texas humor, you know.
Do you think that he's actually nuts? Here's the options here. That he had his motorcycle accident and he came out not quite right. That people rumored that he wasn't quite right, so he played up to it until it became a part of his normal personality. Or he's genuinely nuts.
I think he's a rock and roll dude, you know? I mean, he's a rock drummer. He's been in rock and roll for a long time. Played with Dylan on the Rolling Thunder tour and wrote a song for Nashville. It's in Nashville. He's been a rock and roll guy for a long time, and I think that he's just that's it. I think he's a nutty guy.
And Nick Nolte?
I think Nick Nolte's just a hard drinker. You know what I mean? But yeah, I think he's nutty too.
GHB.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Mean, yeah. I
okay.
Mean, wouldn't you agree? He's a rock and roll dude.
Yeah. Well, he's definitely a little rock and roll. Okay. Before we go, I saw 2000. I've been watching all these.
Oh,
Kubrick
I knew this
movies.
Was coming.
Oh, no. All right.
You
know, go ahead.
Giving in to Jason O'Brien here. Oh, my God.
Look, since we're putting on a Kubrick tribute series.
Right.
You know, it's like an actor preparing for a part. So I'm watching every Kubrick movie. I'm reading all I can about him. We're contacting people related to him, and we're getting them on the show. So, I mean, it's like immersing yourself in Kubrick. So that's what I've been doing. Eyes Wide Shut is still the movie of his that moves me the most. I have tremendous admiration for Kubrick, for his mind, for his ideas, for his work ethic. At the same time, I don't necessarily I'm not necessarily drawn to many of his films. I don't feel them emotionally. I register them from an intellectual standpoint, and that's how I feel about 2001. Particularly, for me, his two most successful movies are Clockwork and Eyes Wide Shut.
Okay.
I think that's okay. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a well. I mean, Kubrick said about 2001 that the truth of it is not in the think of it, but in the feel of it. So
right.
I think Kubrick himself would actually say, I mean, he'd say, well, you can think whatever you like about it, you know, and just prefer to leave it at that. But at the same time, I think that Kubrick would say that 2001 is more of an emotional experience. And it's your emotions that lead you to gather conclusions as to what it all means.
I don't feel 2001 emotionally. I register how groundbreaking and progressive it is in its thinking. I recognize it as, you know, a true sci-fi epic that asks philosophical questions that most don't bother to, in a very deep way. So I admire the hell out of it. You know. I admire the craft of The Shining. I don't really respond to the story as it's told.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I can, you know, I mean, I don't agree, but at the same time, I can understand why someone would say that. I mean, like, for instance, with 2001, do you think that you would have responded to it more emotionally had it been... Had you maybe seen it back in 68, like when it was just the most amazing thing that anybody had ever seen? You know what I'm saying? Like back in 68, it's just...
Yeah. Well, watching it in 70 millimeter in 68, I mean, when you'd never seen anything like that before. And honestly, I haven't seen anything like it since. I mean, I recognize its power. It's just, there's also something about the way the actors play, the way he... directs performance, and you know, I know that the point in 2001 could be, it could be argued that the human characters in it come off stilted and even less human than the computer has,
right,
which grows to become more and more human, jealous, envious, conniving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see that at play. I just don't know. I'm just so conflicted. And
well, you know, I mean, he would shoot things, you know, he would shoot 80 takes because, well, one reason he shot 80 takes on everything that he did, or I'm exaggerating, but he definitely shot at least 40 on everything that he did. And one of the reasons that he did that was because he always said that the thing that he couldn't control was the acting, and one thing about the acting is that a lot of actors came in not knowing their lines, and so he had to, like he said that, and he blamed it all on the method, he blamed it, you know, on Lee Strasberg, but he said that people wouldn't know their lines, and so he had to wait for them to learn their craft while they were on the clock. You know what I'm saying? So he was like, that's why he had to do. I mean, if you look at that Shining documentary, he's going after Shelley Duvall for missing lines.
Well, no.
Look,
I think that that's a little disingenuous that he says that. But Matthew Modine, in our interview that we did with him, he talks about this very thing. He'll be on the Full Metal Jacket portion of our tribute. And he has a big announcement to make about Full Metal Jacket 2 that you guys will have to wait until December to find out. But he talks about that very thing. But in terms of Shelley Duvall, I think that his approach to Shelley Duvall didn't have anything to do with that. I think it was to elicit that emotional exhaustion that character had to be at for 90% of that film. That is an astonishing performance, Shelley Duvall, in that movie.
I think you're right about that. I think he wanted to, like, get her to wear her down, you know, to the point where she – I mean, I think that she was – you could say that, you know, she was seriously afraid for her career in those scenes, you know. I mean, she probably had a great amount of fear, you know, going on in her own, you know, body at that time, you know. So,
and somebody in the chat room mentioned Color Kubrick, the John Malkovich movie, which actually Malkovich has been talking about a lot lately, doing press for Secretariat Red, saying that it's the favorite character he's ever played, and yet he didn't think the movie worked. But the writer-director of that movie, Brian Cook, also collaborated with Kubrick throughout the years on many projects. So we've been in touch with him as well to do the show. So far we've got Dan Richter, who plays Moonwatcher in 2001. We have Matthew Modine. We have Garrett Brown, the inventor of the Steadicam and an essential part of The Shining. And we have a few others that I'm not ready to announce yet. So we've got some exciting stuff coming up in terms of
Kubrick.
That's
pretty. Those are great interviews right there. So.
Yeah, I know.
Trying, you know, maybe you can get Keir Duley or whatever. You know.
Yeah, we're trying.
That would be
we're
great.
Believe me, we're going through the encyclopedia, the phone book with Kubrick.
Uh-huh.
Everyone we can get, we will.
Have you been looking at that Passion book, which I think is the greatest book on Kubrick? The Kubrick archives.
That's actually where the stills from the final scene of The Shining are.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that book a lot of money?
Yes.
Yeah, $200.
All Passion books. All Passion books are expensive.
That's...
They have a Taxi Driver book that's $700.
Oh my God.
They have the
really?
Napoleon. Kubrick's Napoleon, like everything Napoleon related, all the research he did, that's, you know, like a couple of grand or something.
And Christiane Kubrick, doesn't she have a new book out about him as well? Doesn't she, you know, his wife?
Oh, I don't know. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, she has a new book called, I think it's Stanley Kubrick, A Life in Pictures, which I think is the same thing as the documentary.
That Jan Harlan did? Yeah.
Yeah. But I think she has a book out as well. It's interesting, you know. She gave an interview not too long ago to the Sentinel or the London Times or something like that, and it was a very sad interview because she was talking about, you know, what's happened with her daughters.
We're the ones who told you about it. You're in the chat room and you're like, really? I got to look that up.
Oh yeah, that was okay.
Welcome
really
to
Movie
Geeks United.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But anyway, that was very sad. That bummed me out.
I got to try to get Vivian Kubrick to talk about The Shining, you know, and
well,
Full Metal Jacket, which she shot a whole 18 hours of making of footage for Full Metal Jacket. It was never put together in any kind of form. It's all in. She shot 18 hours of making of stuff for Full Metal Jacket.
Oh yeah.
That's one of the things that was in Kubrick's storage that they moved to the museum. They need to build that into another documentary on Kubrick.
I'm really waiting for, you know, they had a huge in Australia and in some places in Europe, they had a huge Kubrick exhibit of all the original props and everything, you know. You know, the box of typewritten, you know, stuff from The Shining, you know, it says all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, that's there, and all that kind of stuff. And when I met with, I met Malcolm McDowell, I had a great year one year because I met Malcolm McDowell, Matthew Modine, and Keir Duley all in one year, which I thought was a pretty pretty big thing, you know. I was like, oh, I can only meet Jack Nicholson now. I never, you know, be a triumph to be complete. But I asked, one of the things I asked Malcolm McDowell was, hey, could you get Priyanka Kubrick to see if she could bring the Kubrick exhibit to maybe something like the Museum of the Moving Image out in Queens, New York, or MoMA, or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
He said, oh, it's incredibly expensive to like ship all that stuff. And I said, yeah, but it would be worth it. I mean, that thing would sell out, you know, every day that it was running, you know. So he said he would talk to her about that. So hopefully he did.
Yeah. And we've got nothing from it since.
Yeah.
So that would be a neat idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be.
I remember going to that Titanic exhibit after that movie came out. And I was dating a girl that wasn't too bright at the time. And if you're listening out there, you know who you are. And so we went to the Titanic exhibit. That was her favorite movie. And you go through and you see, you know, the list of the dead, and then you see the life jackets taken off the dead and everything. And she was talking about what an emotional experience it was, and she said, oh, and at the end, when you saw the life jackets of the people that died there, and she just kind of shook her head, and she was like, that really hit the spot. And I was like, what, did you eat the life jacket? Hit the spot.
Did you eat the life jacket?
It really hit the spot. That's not the right phrase.
Not the right thing to say.
Yeah.
I mean.
Unfortunately, we broke up because I was unable to hit the spot, I think. But, anyway.
Oh, that's crazy. Oh,
okay. Anything
right,
else going on, guys? Jerry?
No, that's all I can think of.
Jerry?
After that statement, yeah.
I think I'm going to go see Unstoppable next week. That Denzel Washington thing.
Are you got a pass to that, or?
Maybe.
Well, my week, you know, my next week or so, it's going to be filled up with going to that documentary festival that you could be in on. So.
Yeah, you're going to be covering another festival for us. And this is like a couple of high-profile documentaries, the new Herzog 3D documentary.
Oh, that should be great.
Yeah,
and... And
Errol
Morris,
tabloid,
and also one that I thought was I was personally interested in because it's about somebody who's important but maybe not as famous as she should be. Her name is Lillian Roxham, or Roxon as I always like to call her, and she did this really seminal bit of music. Reportage in the late 60s called the Rock Encyclopedia, which I think might still be in print, but it's a really great, you know, like early rock encyclopedia that's like nothing I've ever seen. So they have a documentary about her. Apparently she was a huge influence on the rock scene in the 60s, particularly here in New York, even though she was from Australia. And the movie is called Mother of Rock. So they're going to be. It's all about her and lots of you know things like with Iggy Pop and everything. So,
Did she cover Barry Manilow at all?
I don't think that she got to cover Barry, but I will say this. I will say this though. She did in one of her last. She died in 73, and I looked up some of her stuff online, like the trailer for the movie, and they had an interview with her. And she did have, in 73, she did have an interview that said that Bette Midler was going to be one of the hugest things in the world.
Yeah.
And she was also talking up what was then the Dolls, but is now the New York Dolls. So she was saying that they were great, too. And
yeah.
she was right in there with Warhol and Velvet Underground, it's Max's Kansas City, and all that stuff. So it looks like it's going to be a really interesting. That's just as high on my list as the other two.
Did you know I actually have a mini kind of rock musician museum here at my house?
Sorry, really, what's like and what is included in this museum?
Well, above my toilet, I'm not lying about this. above my toilet, I have a framed photo of Elvis. And then on my refrigerator.
I don't know if I really need to know this.
I'm dead serious about this. On my refrigerator, I have a framed photo of Mama Cass. So, like, I'm trying to determine.
For
like,
both of those people, too.
Yes,
because,
I'm
know,
perfect placement.
Yeah,
them,
yeah, really.
Yeah.
I'm so. Trying to figure out how do I complete that museum? Like, what else works in the house to where people died or what they died from or, you know, where I could put more framed photos.
Interesting. Well, I mean, you know, you might want to put didn't Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones die in a swimming pool? So you could put that somewhere around the tub, maybe.
Yeah, but the tub. That's an idea. You really need somebody that actually died in a tub. You know, and I'd have to install a swimming pool before I did Brian Jones thing.
Did Jim Morrison die in the tub? Didn't he die of a heart attack in the tub?
Oh, that's true. He did.
That's right. Yeah, you could get a picture of Jimbo on there, yeah.
Okay.
There
I need something like waterproof to hold the photo of Morrison in.
This is a crazy conversation here.
This really is.
Can you tell we're reaching the end of the show?
Yes, we are definitely reaching the end.
If you ever get a pool, you can put a, you know, like a Brian Jones cut out there or something like
okay.
that.
Okay. I'll do that. All right. Thank you, guys.
Yeah,
Wednesday
that was
night.
Great.
Thank
Wednesday
you.
Night, we're going to come back, Frank Whaley, and we're going to talk about Pulp Fiction and Born on the Fourth and a lot of the stuff on his resume. He's a nice, nice guy, from what I understand from Aaron. So that'll play on Wednesday night. All right, what do I got to close off with? I think our closing theme is what I'm going to close off with tonight.
Really? Nothing special? Nothing?
Hey, that's special.
What are you saying about our closing
know,
theme,
like, you don't have. You don't have like a is the closing theme the same as the opening theme?
No.
Oh, it isn't? Okay.
The closing theme is, you know, what we played for 3 years on the show. The closing theme is more kind of remorseful, a remorseful version of the opening theme. It kind of tells you, oh, damn, Movie Geeks United is over.
Just like the ending of Saturday Night Live, you know, that sad sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but people are usually thankful for the ending of that. Okay.
You're right.
All right, guys. Have a good evening.
All right. See you later.
Good night. Thanks, everyone.
Good night, Jerry.
Good night, Dean.
Good night, John Boy.